The Minority Report. The first thought Anderton had when he saw the young man was, I'm getting bald. Bald and fat and old. But he didn't say it aloud. Instead, he pushed back his chair, got to his feet, and came resolutely around the side of his desk, his right hand rigidly extended. Smiling with forced amiability, he shook hands with the young man. Whitwer? He asked, managing to make his query sound gracious. That's right, the young man said. But the name's Ed to you, of course. That is, if you share my dislike for needless formality. The look on his blonde, overly confident face showed that he considered the matter settled. It would be Ed and John. Everything would be agreeably cooperative right from the start. Did you have much trouble finding the building? Anderton asked, guardedly, ignoring the too friendly overture. Good God. He had to hold on to something. Fear touched him, and he began to sweat. Whitwer was moving around the office as if he already owned it, as if he were measuring it for size. Couldn't he wait a couple of days, a decent interval? No trouble, Whitwer answered blithely, his hands in his pockets. Eagerly he examined the voluminous files that lined the wall. I'm not coming into your agency blind, you understand. I have a few ideas of my own about the way pre-crime is run. Shakily, Anderton lit his pipe. How is it run? I should like to know. Not badly, Whitwer said. In fact, quite well. Anderton regarded him steadily. Is that your private opinion, or is that just cant? Whitwer met his gaze guilelessly. Private and public. The Senate is displeased with your work. In fact, they're enthusiastic. He added, as enthusiastic as very old men can be. Anderton winced, but outwardly he remained impassive. It cost him an effort, though. He wondered what Whitwer really thought. What was actually going on in that close-cropped skull? The young man's eyes were blue, bright, and disturbingly clever. Whitwer was nobody's fool, and obviously had a great deal of ambition. As I understand it, Anderton said cautiously, you're going to be my assistant until I retire. That's my understanding, too, the other replied, without an instant's hesitation. Which may be this year or next year, or 10 years from now. The pipe in Anderton's hand trembled. I'm under no compulsion to retire. I founded pre-crime, and I can stay on here as long as I want. It's purely my decision. Whitwer nodded, his expression still guileless. Of course. With an effort, Anderton cooled down a trifle. I merely wanted to get things straight. From the start, Whitwer agreed. You're the boss. What you say goes. With every evidence of sincerity, he asked, Would you care to show me the organization? I'd like to familiarize myself with the general routine as soon as possible. As they walked along the busy yellow-lit tiers of offices, Anderton said, You're acquainted with the theory of pre-crime, of course? I presume we can take that for granted. I have the information publicly available, Whitwer replied. With the aid of your precog mutants, you boldly and successfully abolished the post-crime punitive system of jails and fines. As we all realize, punishment was never much of a deterrent and could scarcely have afforded comfort to the victim already dead. They had come to the descent lift. As it carried them swiftly downward, Anderton said, You probably grasped the basic legalistic drawback to pre-crime methodology. We're taking in individuals who have broken no law. But they surely will, Whitwer affirmed with conviction. Happily they don't, because we get them first, before they can commit an act of violence. So the commission of the crime itself is absolute metaphysics. We claim they're culpable. They, on the other hand, eternally claim they're innocent. And in a sense, they are innocent. The lift let them out, and they again paced down a yellow corridor. In our society, we have no major crimes, Anderton went on, but we do have a detention camp full of would-be criminals. Doors opened and closed, and they were in an analytical wing. Ahead of them rose impressive banks of equipment, the data receptors and the computing mechanisms that studied and restructured the incoming material. And beyond the machinery sat the three precogs, almost lost to view in the maze of wiring. There they are, Anderton said dryly. What do you think of them? In the gloomy half-darkness, the three idiots sat babbling. Every incoherent utterance, every random syllable was analyzed, compared, reassembled in the form of visual symbols, transcribed on conventional punch cards and ejected into various coded slots. All day long the idiots babbled, imprisoned in their special high-backed chairs, held in one rigid position by metal bands and bundles of wiring, clamps. Their physical needs were taken care of automatically. They had no spiritual needs. Vegetable-like, they muttered and dozed and existed. Their minds were dull, confused, lost in shadows. But not the shadows of today. The three gibbering, fumbling creatures with their enlarged heads and wasted bodies were contemplating the future. The analytical machinery was recording prophecies, and as the three precog idiots talked, the machinery carefully listened. For the first time, Whitwer's face lost its breezy confidence. A sick, dismayed expression crept into his eyes, a mixture of shame and moral shock. "It's not pleasant," he murmured. "I didn't realize they were so..." He groped in his mind for the right word, gesticulating. "So deformed." "Deformed and retarded," Anderton instantly agreed, "especially the girl there. Donna is 45 years old, but she looks about 10. The talent absorbs everything. The ESP lobe shrivels the balance of the frontal area. But what do we care? We get their prophecies. They pass on what we need. They don't understand any of it, but we do." Subdued, Whitwer crossed the room to the machinery. From a slot, he collected a stack of cards. "Are these the names that have come up?" he asked. "Obviously." Frowning, Anderton took the stack from him. "I haven't had a chance to examine them," he explained, impatiently concealing his annoyance. Fascinated, Whitwer watched the machinery pop a fresh card into the now empty slot. It was followed by a second and a third. From the whirring discs came one card after another. "The precogs must see far into the future," Whitwer exclaimed. "They see quite a limited span," Anderton informed him. "1 week or two ahead at the very most. Much of their data is worthless to us, simply not relevant to our line. We pass it on to the appropriate agencies, and they in turn trade data with us. Every important bureau has its cellar of treasured monkeys." "Monkeys?" Whitwer stared at him uneasily. "Oh, yes, I understand. See no evil, speak no evil, etc." "Very amusing. Very apt." Automatically, Anderton collected the fresh cards which had been turned up by the spinning machinery. "Some of these names will be totally discarded, and most of the remainder record petty crimes, thefts, income tax evasion, assault, extortion. As I'm sure you know, pre-crime has cut down felonies by 99.8%. We seldom get actual murder or treason. After all, the culprit knows we'll confine him in the detention camp a week before he gets a chance to commit the crime." "When was the last time an actual murder was committed?" Whitwer asked. 5 years ago," Anderton said, pride in his voice. "How did it happen?" "The criminal escaped our teams. We had his name. In fact, we had all the details of the crime, including the victim's name. We knew the exact moment, the location of the planned act of violence. But in spite of us, he was able to carry it out," Anderton shrugged. "After all, we can't get all of them." He rifled the cards. "But we do get most." "One murder in 5 years," Whitwer's confidence was returning. "Quite an impressive record. Something to be proud of." Quietly, Anderton said, "I am proud. 30 years ago, I worked out the theory, back in the days when the self-seekers were thinking in terms of quick raids on the stock market. I saw something legitimate ahead, something of tremendous social value." He tossed the packet of cards to Wally Page, his subordinate in charge of the monkey block. "See which ones we want," he told him. "Use your own judgment." As Page disappeared with the cards, Whitwer said thoughtfully, "It's a big responsibility." "Yes, it is," agreed Anderton. "If we let one criminal escape, as we did 5 years ago, we've got a human life on our conscience. We're solely responsible. If we slip up, somebody dies." Bitterly, he jerked three new cards from the slot. "It's a public trust." "Are you ever tempted to..." Whitwer hesitated. "I mean, some of the men you pick up must offer you plenty. It wouldn't do any good. A duplicate file of cards pops out at Army GHQ. It's check and balance. They can keep their eye on us continuously as they wish. Anderton glanced briefly at the top card. So even if we wanted to accept a... He broke off, his lips tightening. What's the matter? Whitwer asked, curiously. Carefully, Anderton folded up the top card and put it away in his pocket. Nothing, he muttered. Nothing at all. The harshness in his voice brought a flush to Whitwer's face. You don't really like me, he observed. True, Anderton admitted. I don't. But he couldn't believe he disliked the young man that much. It didn't seem possible. It wasn't possible. Something was wrong. Dazed, he tried to steady his trembling mind. On the card was his name. Line one. An already accused future murderer. According to the coded punches, pre-crime commissioner John A. Anderton was going to kill a man, and within the next week. With absolute, overwhelming conviction, he didn't believe it. In the outer office, talking to Paige, stood Anderton's slim and attractive young wife, Lisa. She was engaged in a sharp, animated discussion of policy and barely glanced up as Whitwer and her husband entered. "Hello, darling," Anderton said. Whitwer remained silent, but his pale eyes flickered slightly as they rested on the brown-haired woman in her trim police uniform. Lisa was now an executive official of pre-crime, but once, Whitwer knew, she had been Anderton's secretary. Noting the interest on Whitwer's face, Anderton paused and reflected. To plant the card in the machines would require an accomplice on the inside, someone who was closely connected with pre-crime and had access to the analytical equipment. Lisa was an improbable element, but the possibility did exist. Of course, the conspiracy could be large-scale and elaborate, involving far more than a rigged card inserted somewhere along the line. The original data itself might have been tampered with. Actually, there was no telling how far back the alteration went. A cold fear touched him as he began to see the possibilities. His original impulse, to tear open the machines and remove all the data, was uselessly primitive. Probably the tapes agreed with the card. He would only incriminate himself further. He had approximately 24 hours. Then the army people would check over their cards and discover the discrepancy. They would find in their files a duplicate of the card he had appropriated. He had only one of two copies, which meant that the folded card in his pocket might just as well be lying on Page's desk in plain view of everyone. From outside the building came the drone of police cars starting out on their routine roundups. How many hours would elapse before one of them pulled up in front of his house? "What's the matter, darling?" Lisa asked him uneasily. "You look as if you've just seen a ghost. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," he assured her. Lisa suddenly seemed to be aware of Ed Whitwer's admiring scrutiny.
"Is this gentleman your new co-worker, darling?" she asked.
Warily, Anderton introduced his new associate. Lisa smiled in a friendly greeting.
Did a covert awareness pass between them? He couldn't tell. God, he was beginning to suspect everybody. Not only his wife and Whitwer, but a dozen members of his staff. Are you from New York? Lisa asked.
No, Whitwer replied. I've lived most of my life in Chicago. I'm staying at a hotel, one of the big downtown hotels.
Wait, I have the name written on a card somewhere.
While he self-consciously searched his pockets, Lisa suggested,
"Perhaps you'd like to have dinner with us. We'll be working in close cooperation, and I really think we ought to get better acquainted."
Startled, Anderton backed off. What were the chances of his wife's friendliness being benign, accidental? Whitwer would be present the balance of the evening and would now have an excuse to trail along to Anderton's private residence. Profoundly disturbed, he turned impulsively and moved toward the door.
"Where are you going?" Lisa asked, astonished.
"Back to the monkey block," he told her. "I want to check over some rather puzzling data tapes before the army sees them." He was out of the corridor before she could think of a plausible reason for detaining him. Rapidly, he made his way to the ramp at its far end. He was striding down the outside stairs toward the public sidewalk when Lisa appeared breathlessly behind him.
"What on earth has come over you?"
Catching hold of his arm, she moved quickly in front of him.
"I knew you were leaving," she exclaimed, blocking his way. "What's wrong with you? Everybody thinks you're..."
She checked herself.
"I mean, you're acting so erratically."
"P. People surged by them, the usual afternoon crowd. Ignoring them, Anderton pried his wife's fingers from his arm. "I'm getting out," he told her, "while there's still time."
"But why?"
"I'm being framed, deliberately and maliciously. This creature is out to get my job. The Senate is getting at me through him." Lisa gazed up at him, bewildered.
"But he seems like such a nice young man."
"Nice as a water moccasin."
Lisa's dismay turned to disbelief.
"I don't believe it. Darling, all the strain you've been under..."
Smiling uncertainly, she faltered.
"It's not really credible that Ed Whitmer is trying to frame you. How could he, even if he wanted to? Surely Ed wouldn't..."
"Ed?"
"That's his name, isn't it?"
Her brown eyes flashed in startled, wildly incredulous protest.
"Good heavens! You're suspicious of everybody. You actually believe I'm mixed up with it in some way, don't you?"
He considered. "I'm not sure." She drew closer to him, her eyes accusing.
"That's not true. You really believe it.
Maybe you ought to go away for a few weeks. You desperately need a rest. All this tension and trauma. A younger man coming in.
You're acting paranoid. Can't you see that?
People plotting against you?
Tell me, do you have an actual proof?"
Anderton removed his wallet and took out the folded card. "Examine this carefully," he said, handing it to her. The color drained out of her face, and she gave a little harsh, dry gasp. "The setup is fairly obvious," Anderton told her, as levelly as he could. "This will give Whitmer a legal pretext to remove me right now. He won't have to wait till I resign." Grimly, he added, "They know I'm good for a few years yet."
"But..."
"It will end the check-and-balance system. Pre-crime will no longer be an independent agency. The Senate will control the police, and after that..." His lips tightened. "They'll absorb the army, too." "Well, it's outwardly logical enough. Of course I feel hostility and resentment toward Whitmer. Of course I have a motive. Nobody likes to be replaced by a younger man and find himself turned out to pasture. It's all really quite plausible, except that I haven't the remotest intention of killing Whitmer. But I can't prove that, so what can I do?" Mutely, her face very white, Lisa shook her head.
I don't know. Darling, if only..."
"Right now," Anderton said abruptly, "I'm going home to pack my things. That's about as far ahead as I can plan."
"You're really going to try to hide out?"
"I am. As far as the Centurion colony planets, if necessary. It's been done successfully before, and I have a 24-hour start."
He turned resolutely. "Go back inside. There's no point in your coming with me." "Did you imagine that I would?" Lisa asked huskily.
Startled, Anderton stared at her.
"Wouldn't you?"
And then, with amazement, he murmured, "No, I can see you don't believe me. You still think I'm imagining all this." He jabbed savagely at the card.
"Even with that evidence, you still aren't convinced." "No," Lisa agreed quickly, "I'm not. You didn't look at it closely enough, darling. Ed Whitmer's name isn't on it."
Incredulous, Anderton took the card from her.
"Nobody says you're going to kill Ed Whitmer," Lisa continued rapidly in a thin, brittle voice. "The card must be genuine, understand? And it has nothing to do with Ed. He's not plotting against you, and neither is anyone else."
Too confused to reply, Anderton stood studying the card. She was right. Ed Whitmer was not listed as his victim. On line 5, the machine had neatly stamped another name. Leopold Kaplan. Numbly, he pocketed the card. He had never heard of the man in his life. The house was cool and deserted, and almost immediately Anderton began making preparations for his journey. While he packed, frantic thoughts passed through his mind.
Possibly he was wrong about Whitmer, but how could he be sure? In any event, the conspiracy against him was far more complex than he had realized. Whitmer, in the overall picture, might be merely an insignificant puppet animated by someone else, some distant, indistinct figure only vaguely visible in the background. It had been a mistake to show the card to Lisa. Undoubtedly, she would describe it in detail to Whitmer. He'd never get off the Earth, never have an opportunity to find out what life on a frontier planet might be like. While he was thus preoccupied, a board creaked behind him. He turned from the bed, clutching a weather-stained winter sports jacket, to face
the muzzle of a gray-blue A-pistol. "It didn't take you long," he said, staring with bitterness at the tight-lipped, heavy-set man in a brown overcoat who stood holding the gun in his gloved hand. "Didn't you even hesitate?" The intruder's face registered no response. "I don't know what you're talking about," he said. "Come along with me." Startled, Anderton laid down the sports jacket. "You're not from my agency? You're not a police officer?" Protesting and astonished, he was hustled outside the house to a waiting limousine. Instantly, three heavily armed men closed in behind him. The door slammed, and the car shot off down the highway, away from the city. Impassive and remote, the faces around him jogged with the motion of the speeding vehicle as open fields, dark and somber, swept past. Anderton was still trying futilely to grasp the implications of what had happened when the car came to a rutted side road, turned off, and descended into a gloomy subsurface garage. Someone shouted an order. The heavy metal lock grated shut, and overhead lights blinked on. The driver turned off the car motor. "You'll have reason to regret this," Anderton warned hoarsely as they dragged him from the car. "Do you realize who I am?" "We realize," the man in the brown overcoat said. At gunpoint, Anderton was marched upstairs from the clammy silence of the garage into a deep carpeted hallway. He was, apparently, in a luxurious private residence set out in the war-devoured rural area. At the far end of the hallway, he could make out a room, a book-lined study, simply but tastefully furnished. In a circle of lamplight, his face partially in shadows, a man he had never met sat waiting for him. As Anderton approached, the man nervously slipped a pair of rimless glasses in place, snapped the case shut, and moistened his dry lips. He was elderly, perhaps 70 or older, and under his arm was a slim silver cane. His body was thin, wiry, his attitude curiously rigid. What little hair he had was dusty brown, a carefully smoothed sheen of neutral color above his pale, bony skull. Only his eyes seemed really alert.
"Is this Anderton?"
he inquired querulously, turning to the man in the brown overcoat.
"Where'd you pick him up?"
"At his home," the other replied. "He was packing, as we expected." The man at the desk shivered visibly.
"Packing?"
He took off his glasses and jerkily returned them to his case.
"Look here," he said bluntly to Anderton. "What's the matter with you?
Are you hopelessly insane?
How could you kill a man you've never met?"
The old man, Anderton suddenly realized, was Leopold Kaplan. "First I'll ask you a question," Anderton countered rapidly. "Do you realize what you've done? I'm commissioner of police. I can have you sent up for 20 years. He was going to say more, but a sudden wonder cut him short.
"How did you find out?" he demanded.
Involuntarily his hand went to his pocket, where the folded card was hidden. "It won't be for another—"
"I wasn't notified through your agency,"
Kaplan broke in with angry impatience.
"The fact that you've never heard of me doesn't surprise me too much. Leopold Kaplan, General of the Army of the Federated West Bloc Alliance."
Begrudgingly, he added,
"retired since the end of the Anglo-Chinese War and the abolishment of AFWA.
It made sense. Anderton had suspected that the Army processed its duplicate cards immediately for its own protection. Relaxing somewhat, he demanded, "Well, you've got me here. What's next?"
"Evidently," Kaplan said, "I'm not going to have you destroyed, or it would have shown up on one of those miserable little cards. I'm curious about you. It seemed incredible to me that a man of your stature could contemplate the cold-blooded murder of a total stranger. There must be something more here. Frankly, I'm puzzled. If it represented some kind of police strategy—"
He shrugged his thin shoulders.
"Surely you wouldn't have permitted the duplicate card to reach us."
"Unless," one of his men suggested, "it's a deliberate plant." Kaplan raised his bright, bird-like eyes and scrutinized Anderton.
"What do you have to say?"
"That's exactly what it is," Anderton said, quick to see the advantage of stating frankly what he believed to be the simple truth. "The prediction on the card was deliberately fabricated by a clique inside the police agency. The card is prepared, and I'm netted. I'm relieved of my authority automatically. My assistant steps in and claims he prevented the murder in the usual efficient pre-crime manner. Needless to say, there is no murder or intent to murder.
I agree with you that there will be no murder,
Kaplan affirmed grimly.
You'll be in police custody. I intend to make sure of that.
Horrified, Anderton protested. You're taking me back there?
If I'm in custody, I will never be able to prove... I don't care what you prove or don't prove,
Kaplan interrupted.
All I'm interested in is having you out of the way,
frigidly he added,
for my own protection.
He was getting ready to leave, one of the men asserted. That's right, Anderton said, sweating. As soon as they get hold of me, I'll be confined in the detention camp. Whitwell will take over, lock, stock, and barrel. His face darkened. And my wife. They're acting in concert, apparently. For a moment, Kaplan seemed to waver.
It's possible, he conceded, regarding Anderton steadily.
Then he shook his head.
I can't take the chance. If this is a frame against you, I'm sorry. But it's simply not my affair.
He smiled slightly.
However, I wish you luck.
To the man he said, take him to the police building and turn him over to the highest authority. He mentioned the name of the acting commissioner and waited for Anderton's reaction.
Whitwer,
Anderton echoed, incredulous. Still smiling slightly, Kaplan turned and clicked on the console radio in the study.
Whitwer has already assumed authority. Obviously, he's going to create quite an affair out of this.
There was a brief static hum, and then, abruptly, the radio blared out into the room. A noisy professional voice reading a prepared announcement.
All citizens are warned not to shelter or in any fashion aid or assist this dangerous marginal individual. The extraordinary circumstance of an escaped criminal at liberty and in a position to commit an act of violence is unique in modern times. All citizens are hereby notified that legal statutes still in force implicate any and all persons failing to cooperate fully with the police in their task of apprehending John Allison Anderton. To repeat, the pre-crime agency of the Federal West Bloc government is in the process of locating and neutralizing its former commissioner, John Allison Anderton, who, through the methodology of the pre-crime system, is hereby declared a potential murderer and, as such, forfeits his rights to freedom and all its privileges.
It didn't take him long, Anderton muttered, appalled. Kaplan snapped off the radio and the voice vanished. Lisa must have gone directly to him, Anderton speculated bitterly.
Why should he wait? Kaplan asked. You made your intentions clear.
He nodded to his men.
Take him back to town. I feel uneasy having him so close. In that respect, I concur with Commissioner Whitwer. I want him neutralized as soon as possible.
Cold, light rain beat against the pavement as the car moved through the dark streets of New York City toward the police building. You can see his point, one of the men said to Anderton. If you were in his place, you'd act just as decisively. Sullen and resentful, Anderton stared straight ahead. Anyhow, the man went on, you're just one of many. Thousands of people have gone to that detention camp. You won't be lonely. Matter of fact, you may not want to leave. Helplessly, Anderton watched pedestrians hurrying across the rain-swept sidewalks. He felt no strong emotion. He was aware only of an overpowering fatigue. Dully, he checked off the street numbers. They were getting near the police station.
This Whitwer seems to know how to take advantage of an opportunity, one of the men observed conversationally. Did you ever meet him?
Briefly, Anderton answered.
He wanted your job, so he framed you.
You sure of that? Anderton grimaced. Does it matter?
I was just curious. The man eyed him languidly. So, you're the ex-commissioner of police. People in the camp will be glad to see you coming. They'll remember you.
No doubt, Anderton agreed.
Whitwer sure didn't waste any time. Kaplan's lucky with an official like that in charge.
The man looked at Anderton almost pleadingly.
You're really convinced it's a plot, eh?
Of course.
You wouldn't harm a hair of Kaplan's head? For the first time in history, pre-crime goes wrong? An innocent man is framed by one of those cards? Maybe there have been other innocent people, right?
It's quite possible, Anderton admitted listlessly.
Maybe the whole system can break down.
Sure, you're not going to commit a murder, and maybe none of them were. Is that why you told Kaplan you wanted to keep yourself outside? Were you hoping to prove the system wrong? I've got an open mind if you want to talk about it. Another man leaned over and asked, just between the two of us, is there really anything to this plot stuff? Are you really being framed? Anderton sighed. At that point, he wasn't certain himself. Perhaps he was trapped in a closed, meaningless time circle with no motive and no beginning. In fact, he was almost ready to concede that he was the victim of a weary, neurotic fantasy spawned by growing insecurity. Without a fight, he was willing to give himself up. A vast weight of exhaustion lay upon him. He was struggling against the impossible, and all the cards were stacked against him. The sharp squeal of tires roused him. Frantically, the driver struggled to control the car, tugging at the wheel and slamming on the brakes as a massive bread truck loomed up from the fog and ran directly across the lane ahead. Had he gunned the motor instead, he might have saved himself, but too late he realized his error. The car skidded, lurched, hesitated for a brief instant, and then smashed head-on into the bread truck. Under Anderton, the seat lifted up and flung him face forward against the door. Pain, sudden, intolerable, seemed to burst in his brain as he lay gasping and trying feebly to pull himself to his knees. Somewhere the crackle of fire echoed dismally, a patch of hissing brilliance winking in the swirls of mist making their way into the twisted hulk of the car. Hands from outside the car reached for him. Slowly he became aware that he was being dragged through the rent that had been the door. A heavy seat cushion was shoved brusquely aside, and all at once he found himself on his feet, leaning heavily against a dark shape and being guided into the shadows of an alley a short distance from the car. In the distance, police sirens wailed.
"You'll live," a voice grated in his ear, low and urgent. It was a voice he'd never heard before, as unfamiliar and harsh as the rain beating into his face. "Can you hear what I'm saying?"
Yes. Anderton acknowledged. He plucked aimlessly at the ripped sleeve of his shirt. A cut on his cheek was beginning to throb. Confused, he tried to orient himself. "You're not..."
"Stop talking and listen."
The man was heavy-set, almost fat. Now his big hands held Anderton propped against the wet brick wall of the building, out of the rain and the flickering light of the burning car.
"We had to do it that way," he said. "It was the only alternative. We didn't have much time. We thought Kaplan would keep you at his place longer."
"Who are you?" Anderton managed. The moist, rain-streaked face twisted into a humorless grin.
"My name's Fleming. You'll see me again. We have about 5 seconds before the police get here. Then we're back where we started."
A flat packet was stuffed into Anderton's hands.
"That's enough loot to keep you going. There's a full set of identification in there. We'll contact you from time to time."
His grin increased and became a nervous chuckle.
"Until you proved your point."
Anderton blinked. "It is a frame-up, then?"
"Of course,"
sharply the man swore.
"You mean they got you to believe it, too?"
"I thought..." Anderton had trouble talking. One of his front teeth seemed to be loose. "Hostility toward Whitwer. Replaced. My wife and a younger man. Natural resentment."
"Don't kid yourself," the other said. "You know better than that. This whole business has worked out carefully. They had every phase of it under control. The card was set to pop the day Whitwer appeared. They've already got the first part wrapped up. Whitwer is commissioner, and you're a hunted criminal."
"Who's behind it?"
"Your wife."
Anderton's head spun.
"You're positive?"
The man laughed.
"You bet your life."
He glanced quickly around.
"Here come the police. Take off down this alley. Grab a bus, get yourself into the slum section, rent a room, and buy a stack of magazines to keep you busy. Get other clothes. You're smart enough to take care of yourself. Don't try to leave Earth. They've got all the inter-system transport screened. If you can keep low for the next 7 days, you're made."
"Who are you?" Anderton demanded. Fleming let him go. Cautiously, he moved to the entrance of the alley and peered out. The first police car had come to rest on the damp pavement, its motor spinning tinnily. It crept suspiciously toward the smoldering ruin that had been Kaplan's car. Inside the wreck, the squad of men were stirring feebly, beginning to creep painfully through the tangle of steel and plastic out into the cold rain.
"Consider us a protective society,"
Fleming said softly, his plump, expressionless face shining with moisture.
a sort of police force that watches the police. To see, he added, that everything stays on an even keel.
His thick hand shot out. Stumbling, Anderton was knocked away from him, half falling into the shadows and damp debris that littered the alley.
Get going, Fleming told him sharply. And don't discard that packet.
As Anderton felt his way hesitantly toward the far exit of the alley, the man's last words drifted to him.
Study it carefully, and you may still survive.
The identification cards described him as Ernest Temple, an unemployed electrician drawing a weekly subsistence from the state of New York, with a wife and four children in Buffalo and less than $100 in assets. A sweat-stained green card gave him permission to travel and to maintain no fixed address. A man looking for work needed to travel. He might have to go a long way. As he rode across town in the almost empty bus, Anderton studied the description of Ernest Temple. Obviously, the cards had been made out with him in mind, for all the measurements fitted. After a time, he wondered about the fingerprints and the brainwave pattern. They couldn't possibly stand comparison. The wallet full of cards would get him past only the most cursory examinations, but it was something. And with the ID cards came $10,000 in bills. He pocketed the money and cards, then turned to the neatly typed message in which they had been enclosed. At first, he could make no sense of it. For a long time, he studied it, perplexed. The existence of a majority logically implies a corresponding minority. The bus had entered the vast slum region, the tumbled miles of cheap hotels and broken-down tenements that had sprung up after the mass destruction of the war. It slowed to a stop, and Anderton got to his feet. A few passengers idly observed his cut cheek and damaged clothing. Ignoring them, he stepped down onto the rain-swept curb. Beyond collecting the money due him, the hotel clerk was not interested. Anderton climbed the stairs to the second floor and entered the narrow, musty-smelling room that now belonged to him. Gratefully, he locked the door and pulled down the window shades. The room was small but clean. Bed, dresser, scenic calendar, chair, lamp, a radio with a slot for the insertion of quarters. He dropped a quarter into it and threw himself heavily down on the bed. All main stations carried the police bulletin. It was novel, exciting, something unknown to the present generation. An escaped criminal. The public was avidly interested.
This man has used the advantage of his high position to carry out an initial escape, the announcer was saying with professional indignation. Because of his high office, he had access to the previewed data, and the trust placed in him permitted him to evade the normal process of detection and relocation. During the period of his tenure, he exercised his authority to send countless potentially guilty individuals to their proper confinement, thus sparing the lives of innocent victims. This man, John Allison Anderton, was instrumental in the original creation of the pre-crime system, the prophylactic pre-detection of criminals through the ingenious use of mutant precogs, capable of previewing future events and transferring orally that data to analytical machinery. These three precogs, in their vital function...
The voice faded out as he left the room and entered the tiny bathroom. There he stripped off his coat and shirt and ran hot water into the washbowl. He began bathing the cut on his cheek. At the drugstore on the corner, he had bought iodine and band-aids, a razor, comb, toothbrush, and other small things he would need. The next morning, he intended to find a second-hand clothing store and buy more suitable clothing. After all, he was now an unemployed electrician, not an accident-damaged commissioner of police. In the other room, the radio blared on. Only subconsciously aware of it, he stood in front of the cracked mirror, examining a broken tooth.
The system of three precogs finds its genesis in the computers of the middle decades of this century. How are the results of an electronic computer checked? By feeding the data to a second computer of identical design. But two computers are not sufficient. If each computer arrived at a different answer, it is impossible to tell a priori which is correct. The solution, based on a careful study of statistical method, is to utilize a third computer to check the results of the first two. In this manner, a so-called majority report is obtained. It can be assumed with fair probability that the agreement of 2 out of 3 computers indicates which of the alternative results is accurate. It would not be likely that 2 computers would arrive at identically incorrect solutions. Anderton dropped the towel he was clutching and raced into the other room. Trembling, he bent to catch the blaring words of the radio. "Unanimity of all 3 precogs is a hoped-for but seldom achieved phenomenon," Acting Commissioner Whitwer explains. "It is much more common to obtain a collaborative majority report of 2 precogs plus a minority report of some slight variation, usually with reference to time and place, from the 3rd mutant. This is explained by the theory of multiple futures. If only 1 time path existed, precognitive information would be of no importance, since no possibility would exist in possessing this information of altering the future. In the pre-crime agency's work, we must first of all assume..." Frantically, Anderton paced around the tiny room. Majority report. Only 2 of the precogs had concurred on the material underlying the card. That was the meaning of the message enclosed with the packet. The report of the 3rd precog, the minority report, was somehow of importance. Why? His watch told him that it was after midnight. Page would be off duty. He wouldn't be back in the monkey block until next afternoon. It was a slim chance, but worth taking. Maybe Page would cover for him, and maybe not. He would have to risk it. He had to see the minority report. Between noon and 1 o'clock, the rubbish-littered streets swarmed with people. He chose that time, the busiest part of the day, to make his call. Selecting a phone booth in a patron-teeming super drugstore, he dialed the familiar police number and stood holding the cold receiver to his ear. Deliberately, he had selected the odd, not the vid line. In spite of his second-hand clothing and seedy, unshaven appearance, he might be recognized. The receptionist was new to him. Cautiously, he gave Page's extension. If Whitwer were removing the regular staff and putting in his satellites, he might find himself talking to a total stranger. "Hello," Page's gruff voice came. Relieved, Anderton glanced around. Nobody was paying any attention to him. The shoppers wandered among the merchandise, going about their daily routines. "Can you talk?" he asked. "Or are you tied up?" There was a moment of silence. He could picture Page's mild face torn with uncertainty as he wildly tried to decide what to do. At last came halting words.
Why are you calling here?"
Ignoring the question, Anderton said, "I didn't recognize the receptionist. New personnel?"
"Brand new," Page agreed in a thin, strangled voice. "Big turnovers these days."
"So I hear." Tensely, Anderton asked, "How's your job? Still safe?"
"Oh, wait a minute."
The receiver was put down and the muffled sound of steps came in Anderton's ear. It was followed by the quick slam of a door being hastily shut. Page returned.
We can talk better now," he said hoarsely.
"How much better?"
"Not a great deal. Where are you?"
"Strolling through Central Park," Anderton said, "enjoying the sunlight." For all he knew, Page had gone to make sure the line tap was in place. Right now, an airborne police team was probably on its way, but he had to take the chance.
"I'm in a new field," he said curtly.
"I'm an electrician these days."
"Oh?"
Page said, baffled. "I thought maybe you had some work for me. If it can be arranged, I'd like to drop by and examine your basic computing equipment, especially the data and analytical banks in the monkey block." After a pause, Page said,
It might be arranged. If it's really important..."
"It is," Anderton assured him. "When would be best for you?"
"Well," Page said, struggling, "I'm having a repair team come in to look at the intercom equipment. The acting commissioner wants it improved so he can operate quicker. You might trail along."
"I'll do that. About when?"
"Say 4 o'clock. Entrance B, level 6. I'll meet you."
"Fine," Anderton agreed, already starting to hang up.
"I hope you're still in charge when I get there."
He hung up and rapidly left the booth. A moment later, he was pushing through the dense pack of people crammed into the nearby cafeteria. Nobody would locate him there. He had 3.5 hours to wait, and it was going to seem a lot longer.
It proved to be the longest wait of his life before he finally met Paige as arranged. The first thing Paige said was,
"You're out of your mind. Why in hell did you come back?"
"I'm not back for long." Tautly, Anderton prowled around the monkey block, systematically locking one door after another. "Don't let anybody in. I can't take chances."